My name is Peyton Williams. I'm one of the board members of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. And it's my pleasure today to introduce Allison Ball as our speaker today on U.S. immigration, the basics. Now, Allison earned a BA from Cornell University and an MBA from the Wharton School. And after a career in corporate marketing and international strategy, she worked as a microfinance troubleshooter in Africa and Central Asia. She moved to Charlottesville in 2003 and has been consulting with and taught nonprofit boards and their executive directors. Currently, Allison volunteers as a member of the Community Development Committee of the International Refugee Committee. I hope that's right.
Rescue.
My brain wasn't quite going to work fast enough on that one. That resettles refugees in Central Virginia, which is a bit she'll be talking about. For the last 5 years, Allison has spent winters in South Arizona and has studied U.S. immigration, giving fact-based presentations about U.S. immigration to the general public nationwide. And as someone said to me, after 5 years of doing this, I am sure her presentation will be very, very good. So with that, Allison, I hope you're all ready to start up.
I sure am. I sure am, Peyton. Thank you very much. And thanks for having me here with you today. And thank you to all of you in the audience for coming. I'll pull up my screen share here of my slide presentation. I've got about 16 slides today, and I'll be talking for about 45 minutes about immigration. Now, for those of you who've heard me speak before, you know that I'm a fact-based presenter, and I'm really not here to convince you of anything. I'm here to give you some basic information about U.S. immigration, and I'll let you decide for yourself whether we're on track or we're not, based on where you think we should be or where you think we need to be. So I'm going to try to advance the slides. And I'm not. There we go. Here's our agenda today. We're going to start with a little bit of history, and I'm going to spend some time giving you an overview of immigration as it stands today. I want to, in number two, give you the context of the government and what the government does with relation to immigration. Homeland Security, I'm going to talk about detention a little bit, and I'll talk about our courts. I want to talk a little bit about the unauthorized residents, those you might have heard termed the undocumented or the illegal aliens. They really are not undocumented. Many have documentation. They're just not authorized to live here in the States. I want to talk to you a little bit about what Trump has done, what changes he's made in our immigration system, and what impact that had on the system. And then I step back and say, why is immigration important to us here in this country? And then what do we see Biden doing, and what do we expect Congress to be doing in the future? So that's our agenda. If you have questions during the presentation, please feel free to put them in the Q&A. Peyton's going to be looking through those questions during the presentation. And at the end, there'll be plenty of time for questions. We'll start with those that came into the Q&A, and then we'll open it up for other questions at that time. So let's get started. There's a long history here, as you can imagine, of immigration. I've just picked out really two of the most significant parts of our immigration history. As you recall, as a New World country, we really tried to accept as many people as we could, particularly from Europe in the very beginning. And in the early 1700s and throughout most of the 1700s, as long as you were a free white man, you could come to the States, you could come to this country, and you could become a citizen just by registering with the government, returning a couple years later, and becoming a citizen. It was very easy early on to become a citizen of this country. Now, two significant changes happened. One is this 14th Amendment in 1868. It was after the Civil War. And at that time, we passed the 14th Amendment that said all persons born or naturalized in the U.S. are citizens. Now, what that did was it put the U.S. in one of two categories. It put us into the right of the soil. It said, if you are born on this soil, you are a citizen of this country. Most of our hemisphere, most of North and South America have this kind of system for immigration because we were always encouraging people to come and populate our new countries after they were, quote, discovered. Now, the opposite is what most of the rest of the world operates under. If you were from Africa or Europe or Asia, you would be the right of the blood. You would be a citizen of the country based on your parents' blood. And so the lineage was more important. Now, these things are relaxing today, but I just wanted you to be aware that in our system, because of an amendment to the Constitution, we have the jus soli, the right of the soil, which means anyone born here is a U.S. citizen. And if we want to change that, we would need to change and amend the Constitution. Now, in 1924, we passed our first really comprehensive immigration system. And eventually that was amended in 1965 in the Immigration and Naturalization Act. What this did was it put our immigration system, the basics of it, as family preferences. We said we will prefer to bring people from around the world who are related to other people who are already here, and in some cases, people who have skills that we need. We also put at the time into this system and into the law, country caps. You'll see a little bit of the effect of that coming up later. And also we started the implementation of temporary visas. So this is a very, very long, comprehensive immigration law, and it's the basis of our laws today. We'll see in a minute how that plays out with visas, but most people would agree that this system is quite inflexible, quite specific, and maybe doesn't give us as much flexibility as we'd like. Of course, the devil's in the details, and it's difficult to get agreement on what would make a better system. But when we say we are looking at or considering immigration reform, comprehensive immigration reform at the congressional level, we're saying make changes to this basic immigration law that's the basis of all of our immigration today. So this boils down about 180 different visas that are in that 1965 INA, that basic immigration law we just talked about. And in a typical year, not a COVID year, but in a typical year, we would take in about 1 million people, 1 million immigrants who had pathways to citizenship. And what this does, this chart collapses the 186 different visas into three main categories. It says some people come here based on family connections, about 750,000 a year. Used to do that. We have some people who come here based on employment-based qualifications, high-level people, doctors, PhDs, scientists with very specialized skills. So that's the second category. And the third category is a humanitarian category that's made up of refugees and asylum seekers. Now note that under number two, the employment-based visas that are the pathways to citizenship are also being fed by the H-1B visa category. H-1Bs are temporary skilled visas. They're not here permanently. There's no pathway to citizenship to the H-1B. But currently in our system, we have a little bit of a backlog. Over 500,000 people who are H-1Bs are waiting to get through the system into that 140 slots of the employment-based pathways to citizenship. So this just highlights one of the problems of the system that we have. We are not necessarily accommodating the work that we need done here with our visa system. And like I said, we don't have a flexible system in order to accommodate that. Now, remember that 1 million citizens per year, because that's going to be a key number in the future. I like this chart because it allows us to look at the legal immigrants over time. What you're looking at is a series of columns, and each column is a decade. And each column then says how many people in that decade have come here legally. And you can see the ramp up from the early 1800s through the 1900s, and then a drop off based on economic conditions and World War I, and then the eventual buildup again. But what I want you to notice is that in the first 100 years, most of the people who came to this country were from England. But then in the second century, in the 1900s, that really diversified. There were not only people from Europe, but there were also many people from Asia, and there were also many people from South America, Mexico, Canada, and a much more of a diversified group. And that's because in that 1965 law, we made changes to the system that forced us to take immigrants from all over the world, not just as we had been in the past as a European-based country. So we're going to jump now to the Department of Homeland Security, which you all know used to be the INS, and it was part of the Department of Justice before 9/11. And once we developed the Department of Homeland Security, not only did it include lots of these immigration organizations, but it includes people like FEMA, it includes the Coast Guard. So that became the Department of Homeland Security. The ones we're concerned with are the following. The first is Customs and Border Protection. Now, if you were to fly home from Europe into Dulles Airport, you would have somebody going through your suitcase. Customs and Border Protection would be at the airport to inspect you, to inspect your luggage, and also Customs and Border Protection inspects any goods that are imported into the U.S. We see these people also in Arizona at the Nogales port of entry. Also, we have border patrol agents. Now, border patrol agents are along the borders, but they police really between the ports of entry. And we see these people not only at the border, but in Arizona currently, there are 32 checkpoints that are inside the state line. And they stop people going through, driving around, looking for people who may be here without the proper without the proper authorization in those vehicles. So again, we have Customs and Border Protection at the ports of entry, and we have Border Patrol agents who are between the ports of entry. They wear the green versus the blue that you'd see at the airports. We also have ICE. Now, we would have more exposure to ICE here in Charlottesville than we would Customs and Border Protection. These are people all over the country who are actually implementing and enforcing the rules of picking people up if they're here unauthorized, in an unauthorized fashion. And you can see that ICE now has about 20,000 employees and about 400 offices nationwide. They also manage the detention centers. We'll talk about detention centers in a minute. And we have a detention center near us in Farmville, Virginia. The third part of Homeland Security that I just wanted to alert you to was this USCIS, which it helps with the naturalizations of citizens. If you were applying for temporary visas, if you were applying for permanent visas, any of the family visas, you would need to go through the processing of USCIS. These are the people that interview people to become citizens. They start with people overseas. Most people that come here with pathways to citizens are vetted overseas before they even get to this country. And these are the people that do this work. They process the paperwork. They do the citizenship test that we've all heard about. And they charge the fees in order to do that. So again, this is the Department of Homeland Security. Let's take a look at the detention centers, which are quite controversial. The first line that you see there I'll just tell you what those numbers mean. The percentage is the percentage of inmates or those held in detention, the percentage of inmates that are in the category that you see. So, and the next number is the number of centers in that category. So for example, of all the detention centers in the US, the federally owned and operated detention centers hold 10% of the population, and there are 5 detention centers in that category. So you can see some are local. In some cases, local facilities have been converted to hold immigrants. For example, here in Virginia, there's a Carolina County detention center that now houses immigrants. And this is by contract, the federal government would contract with that local entity to hold immigrants in that facility. Maybe the facility wasn't being used, but you can see there are about 156 or more facilities around the country being used in that manner, that local facilities have been converted. And then the majority, you can see, the majority of the inmates are held in for-profit detention centers, of which there are about 60. There are some large companies that are involved in this, and the example that I've listed there for you is one called CoreCivic that owns about 128 facilities nationwide. Some of them are oriented towards immigrants, some are state facilities, some are federal facilities, and they're a for-profit entity, and you can buy and sell their stock on the New York Stock Exchange. Now, look, the way we look at the information about detention centers and the way we budget for detention centers is to think, well, what will the federal government charge or what will they pay? What are they willing to pay to hold these inmates? And I've seen a range of costs, and it ranges depending on the facility that they're in, anywhere from $100 to $200 per day per inmate. And so when you are looking at federal budgets, you will see large numbers of large amounts of money set aside in order to house immigrant detainees. There is also what's called alternatives to detention. Some of the people argue against whether these people should be held in detention at all or not. Remember, any charge against an immigrant is a civic charge. It's not a civil charge. It's not a criminal charge if it's immigration related. And so there are alternatives to detention. There are ankle bracelets that you must be required to wear that monitor where you're located. And of course, the cost of that alternative to detention is quite a bit less than it might cost to house someone in a detention center. And obviously, there's been a lot of controversy during COVID of the safety of holding some of these folks in detention centers. The average number of beds per day, again, is a statistic that you would see in a budget for the Department of Homeland Security and ICE, who manages the detention centers. And you can see the numbers. They had been going up until about 2019. You can see the number there. There were about 52,000 inmates per day on average during the year of 2019. It dropped way back during COVID. And as you can see the number, by 2020, we were down to about 17,000 inmates, which I think is about the number where we are currently in immigrant detention. We're going to take a little bit of a look at the immigration courts. The two things that really surprised me about the courts, first of all, the immigration courts are embedded in the Department of Justice. And as you remember from your civics classes, the Department of Justice is part of the executive branch. So in fact, these immigration courts are not really separate courts in the judiciary branch. They're embedded in the executive branch. And so there's been some criticism and some questioning of whether this is a good idea because of the political persuasion of the attorney general who might be appointed by, say, the president and have an opinion that is politically motivated rather than looking at it as a strictly judiciary matter. So that was the first thing that really surprised me when I started my studies. Now, the second thing was that immigration is, as I said before, a civil matter. And unlike what you see on TV, where there's always a representative, if it's a federal criminal matter, legal representation is not required by law in immigration courts, which is why we've seen in the past, sadly, some children standing up in front of an immigration judge trying to answer questions from the judge, et cetera, because there's no requirement for those children to have legal representation with them in that court. So again, this is a bit of a controversial matter. Now, I just wanted to list for you how many courts. There's about 63 courts around the country. The closest one to us is in Arlington, Virginia. And the number of judges has been increased during the Trump administration to about 520. And those judges are appointed for their lifetimes. When I first started doing this work about 5 years ago, there were 700,000 to 800,000 cases in the backlog. Now we're up to about 1.3 million cases in backlog. And those people are either sitting in detention, or they've been bonded out, they've paid money to get out of detention, or they're living on the economy and they're waiting for their hearing. So in the case of Arlington, if you were to step into the court today for the first time, your court hearing might be 3 or 4 years out. With COVID, obviously, this has been elongated because these courts were closed for a certain length of time, and they're only opening up now, and they're opening up on Zoom. If you go into the immigration court and you lose your case, you have 30 days to file an appeal. The appeal goes to what's called the Board of Immigration Appeals. Again, this is part of the Department of Justice. One of the things that happened during the Trump administration, you'll see, and I'll talk about this in a minute, you'll see that the Attorney General has the right to reach down into this Board of Immigration Appeals and make decisions on the board's behalf. And so this was happening during the Trump administration. Once you, if you decide you want to appeal again, you start moving into the circuit courts. Now this moves away from the Department of Justice and you're into the judiciary side of the house. And so you can then appeal to the circuit courts. And in a few cases, we've seen the cases go to the Supreme Court. Both of those last two would be outside the Department of Justice. But that's just a snapshot of what's going on with the courts. Now, let's back up a little bit and take a look at immigrants in general in the U.S. And these are 2016 numbers. And as you can imagine, if we are doing these numbers in 2010, right after a census, we might have pretty good numbers. But as we move further and further away from that, the decade the year when the census has been done, the numbers get a little murky. So these are based on Pew estimates. And remember, immigrants, really the definition is foreign born. So in the U.S., foreign born, we have about 45 million immigrants, people who've come to this country, but they were born somewhere else. Now, of those, 44% have become naturalized citizens. So they've come in through that system of visas, either a family preference, an employment-based, or humanitarian. They've gone through the process of living here for a while, getting a green card, and then becoming a naturalized citizen. So about 44%. That lawful permanent resident, that's the same as a green card. So about 12.2 million of those people have green cards. They have the option with green cards to become citizens. They don't ever have to become citizens, but they would apply through that USCIS if they wanted to. So again, a certain percentage of those are green card holders, and they're either processing through to the citizenship or they're choosing not to. And then temporary lawful residents, either are here with student visas, they're here with business visas, but they're residing here for more than just a week or two. They're not travel visas. They're here living here, and that's about 2 million. Now, as you see the upper left, that purple, the unauthorized, these are the undocumented, or what you know is being quite controversial in our discussions these days. So about 25% or 24% of the total bucket are these unauthorized. And I just wanted to say a few words about this population. One of the things that surprised me about this group, the unauthorized group, was that of the total, 58% are border crossers, people that you would see probably going past our southern border, not really so many come through the northern border, versus 42% are visa overstayers. So these are people who the visa overstayers probably came as a student visa holder, or maybe a business visa holder, or a travel visa holder, and they just overstayed their visa, and they stayed longer and longer, and they were able to establish permanent residency here. So again, if we're thinking about a solution to the unauthorized issue, we want to take into account that some of the people are crossing the border and some of the people are overstaying their visa. And as it turns out, increasingly, more and more percentage, a greater percentage of people are these visa overstayers versus the border crossers every year. The border crossers have actually been going down over the last decade, and the visa overstayers have been going up. So it's just part of the puzzle. Now, they've lived here for quite a while. Two-thirds have lived in the U.S. 10 years or longer, and I think almost a third have lived here 20 years or longer. So these are people who really integrated into our communities, and their children have gone to schools, et cetera. And the thing that surprised me and that I really wasn't aware of is that we have about 4.7 million U.S. citizen children that have one or two unauthorized parents. So remember, based on that right of the soil, because if you're born here, you're a U.S. citizen, we have lots of U.S. citizen children being born to either one or both unauthorized. Now, this final statistic is the result of COVID, and COVID has uncovered some very interesting things about our economy and about the immigrants that live here. Of the 11 million who are unauthorized, about 7 million of those work. And of the 7 million who work, about 5 million of those unauthorized have been deemed essential COVID frontline workers. This is deemed by the Department of Homeland Security themselves. So what we're seeing is our U.S. economy is really based on the infrastructure of these 5 million unauthorized workers. And I've listed some of the jobs that they're doing as farm workers, food processors, food service people, and then all of our home and healthcare and parental and children care workers in our homes. These are the job enabling jobs, meaning I get to stay home because somebody else is doing this work, or I get to do my job in my home because someone's taking care of my parent or child. So they're deemed job enabling jobs. But this 5 million was something that I think is starting to become known more and more. And we'll see this when we look at the legislation that people are recommending. We'll see this 5 million come up again. So what did Trump do during his administration? It was an interesting article I read recently. One of the professors, Gutentag is his name, up at Yale, kept track of all of the changes to the immigration that the Trump and his administration were doing throughout the 4 years. And I think there were something like 1,400 changes. These were major things we would see in the news, but also minor things that were happening behind the scenes. I was trying to keep track of it myself and sort of lost track of it. But what I did was establish this list so that I could take a look for myself and see what were the different ways that Trump made changes to the immigration system. And this is just a partial list, some of the things you'll be familiar with. He signed executive orders. You remember that he put a cap on the refugees that could enter the U.S. every year, and that was reduced year after year. He established the travel bans. Remember, in the beginning, they were quite controversial, and eventually they were sent to the Supreme Court, and one was upheld. And the decision at that time was, yes, the president does have the authority to make the decision and the determination that people from certain countries are not welcome here because either our ability to vet them is not appropriate or we have no way to be sure that we want to keep people from the country from entering. DACA, as you remember, was something that was established by President Obama during his term and was terminated during the Trump administration, not successfully. Most of these things were being argued in the courts throughout his tenure. There were also 48 COVID-related executive orders that impacted immigrants. In that basic law, that 1965 law, the INA, there it tells us how we need to change the rules that govern how we manage the system. And so some of the ways that we needed to change the rule require what's called the Federal Register. You must register the new language, you must show it to the public, you must open up for public comment. And I've just listed two examples there of the public charge rule and the mammoth asylum rule. We can talk about that a little bit later if you're interested. But both of these items went through the process of the rule was filed. The public had 60 or 90 days to make their public comments. The rule was then reissued based on those comments. As it turns out, both of the items listed went into the court system and were not deemed appropriate. So neither one of these was actually implemented in the law, but those were some of the things that were happening. Attorney general decisions, we've talked about the significance of the attorney general and the power that that position holds because they have the ability to dictate to those judges how to make decisions and provide new precedents based on whatever decisions they'd like to make at the time and whatever court cases they're seeing come through the system. But we're also seeing internal memos. We're seeing places where there is discretionary authority that is being swayed one way or another. There are obviously personnel decisions. One of the things down there, number six, that President Trump did was at the border when someone comes in, the first, basically one of the first steps is to have a credible fear interview with the asylum seeker to see if they have a basic case to seek asylum. And that's generally done with an asylum officer that has weeks and weeks of training for how to conduct the interviews. And one of the decisions that was made during the Trump administration was to transfer that skill and that that job to the Customs and Border Patrol, which I'm not so sure went so well. And I think that's been reversed since Biden has come into power. But that's an example of a personnel decision. Obviously, we've heard about budgetary decisions, taking defense money and putting it towards the border wall. And then there were even international agreements that changed the face of immigration. So I wanted to just give you this list because even though immigration is a federal issue and it's under federal law that we see the immigration decisions made, there were many ways that the Trump administration was able to change the system without really even touching those laws at all, just through the power of the administration. So I wanted to step back and say, well, why do I care? Why, as an American, do I care about this system at all? Why should I care that the immigration system used to have a million? In fact, I want to just back up here and remind you of one thing. the million a year, remember, typically we would see a million a year coming into the system. But then notice here, during the Trump administration, that second line, the impact of his changes and his decisions was that the projection for this year is that immigrants have dropped to 600,000. So the question is, why should I, as just a normal everyday American, care that we used to take in a million and now we're going to take in 600,000? And here are my reasons. We really have historically been a nation of immigrants, and we currently have about 14.5% of an immigrant population. And so this is kind of the history of our country, and we think that this is an important thing to maintain. But also, our U.S. economy very much depends on immigrants. You saw the statistics before that the 5 million non-documented or unauthorized immigrants are really part of the infrastructure of our economy. And statistics and economists agree that 2% of the growth in any year is dependent on those million immigrants. So all of our projections for growth depend on the immigrants coming and being here in order to maintain that growth. And we also know that 44% of the companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange are, or not the entire stock exchange, excuse me, the S&P 500, 44% of the S&P 500, thank you, were started by immigrants or their children. So our growth, really, we find that the immigrants tend to be creative. They tend to be, creative business owners, and they're starting companies that are going to not only hire more immigrants, but they're going to be hiring the native borns like me, like our children, and like our grandchildren. So again, this is an important part of who we are. And we know, if we look around the world, that European countries and the U.S., which is not replacing its workers, we have a lower birth rate than to replace our workers. We need to keep bringing these immigrants in for our economy to continue to grow. Number three, there, our world leadership definitely relies on our ability to maintain successful diversity. I've read several articles lately that say, let's take a look at, for example, the Syrian situation, when so many refugees fled Syria, and there were probably 6 or 7 million who fled Syria about 4 or 5 years ago. Some of those ended up in Syria, in Lebanon. Some ended up in Jordan. Many ended up in Turkey. Many went in through to Europe. But there were many millions who left that country. What has happened is that people generally move to some regional location that can't handle the influx of the refugees. And so unless we're participants in the discussion of where those refugees are going and how they will be handled, we are going to be at high risk here. And I've read more articles about our security depending on our ability to be a participant in these discussions and in this process. People are just realizing that because we've retreated a bit from this, we're seeing some risks here that we may not want to take. Now, that number four is my own personal note. And I think it's easy for me to sit before you and talk about the statistics and the numbers, but I don't want us to ever forget that there are people behind all these numbers. There are people trying to move around. There are people trying to reunite with their families. And our system needs to be fair and it needs to be kind. And I think we can have a system that is secure and at the same time that is humanitarian. but we don't want to forget that these are decisions that we're making about people and their people's lives. I wanted to just take one slide and tell you what Americans think. Now, this is based on a Pew Research Center from 2019. The first one, and I just take it directly from the survey, 73% say that admitting refugees escaping war and violence is a very or somewhat important goal. So what this says is 73% of the American population thinks that our refugee system of vetting overseas and bringing people here so they can join our nation is a very or somewhat important goal. A second statistic, 77% understand that undocumented immigrants mostly fill jobs that U.S. citizens do not want. One of the controversies of the undocumented population is the notion that people will be losing their jobs. Americans will lose their jobs if we allow more people into the country. The economic studies that I have read say, by and large, that's not true. That in fact, the undocumented immigrants take mostly jobs that Americans will not take and do not want. Even when those jobs are open and offered to Americans, they don't take them or they are not successful in keeping them. The one group that is perhaps at the highest at risk is that group, the minority groups here in this country, American citizens who are minorities with low levels of education. I have seen some statistics that say that there could be some erosion of those wages, but by and large, there is no harm to the Americans from the undocumented immigrants economically. The third statistic there, 67% agree that it is very or somewhat important to establish a way for most immigrants in the country illegally to remain here legally. Now, what this is when we think about allowing a pathway to citizenship for those 11 million, two-thirds of us agree that it is very or somewhat important to establish a way for people to stay here. Historically, the U.S. has provided pathway to citizenship for some people. You may recall in 1986, President Reagan did this. He allowed some general undocumented workers and some agricultural undocumented workers to ask for or request or apply for pathways to citizenship. We'll see again in the legislation that's being proposed, we'll see some of this coming up. But Pew would tell you that over time, this statistic has been quite standard. There's not been any changes in this two-thirds of the American public think that those who are here, that having a pathway to citizenship is a good idea. Now, if you were to ask the question, what about the people who aren't here, who are yet to come? That's a totally different story. But the attitude about the people who are here is quite clear and has been quite consistent. Now, the thing that I noticed is that last line there, that there was a different study this year, 2020, so late last year, that basically said, how important is immigration? And in 2020, only a third of our nation thought that immigration was critical. And that's down from 49%. So this issue had a much higher profile earlier on, but it's dropped. And when I think about the context of the issues, these are the same issues I think we're all worried about. COVID, number one, healthcare, health issues, the economy, all these issues are critical. And what we've seen, I think, in recent months is a little bit of a drop down as to how critical immigration is in the eyes of the general public. So let's turn to what Biden has done. There have been a lot of discussions, and I'm sure you've seen this in the news. President Biden came out of the gate and started signing executive orders. Some of these things are reversing what Trump had done. Some of these issues are new, and some of these issues are trying to push forward new legislation that's going to change the immigration, that INA, upgrade it and give this comprehensive immigration reform. So what are we seeing? We're seeing the refugee caps, that executive order, we're still waiting for that to come out, but it should come out any day now, saying how many refugees will we have coming into the system, reversing the travel bans. MPP was a system, it was called the Migrant Protection Protocol, or Remain in Mexico. And what it said was, even though in the past an asylum seeker would present themselves at the port of entry or elsewhere and ask for asylum and get their credible fear interview, normally they would go and live with their family sponsor or another sponsor in the country and wait for their hearing in that backlogged immigration court. But in the case of Trump, he sent about 70,000 people back into Mexico to wait for their court hearing. And they're living really at the northern part, in the northern part of Mexico at the border, waiting for their court hearings, either in Texas or in Arizona or over in California. That executive order was reversed. And some of those people are starting to come through the border now, and they'll be sent out to live with their sponsor families throughout the country. The border wall, of course, the construction has ceased. DACA has sort of been refortified. There's still a Supreme Court case that's going through the system, and we're waiting to hear whether the Supreme Court will be allowing DACA to continue on or not. He's also started some very interesting new task forces for new Americans. His understanding that it's not just bringing people here and resettling them that counts. It's the integration that we need to keep working on. It's not just good enough to bring them here and set them up financially for the short term. We need to all come together to put these new Americans as much integrated into the system as we possibly can. The Family Reunification Task Force has their hands full. There are still 1,000 children that have not been reunited with their parents. And so they're trying to put those families back together. They're looking at all kinds of issues related to finding the parents, first of all, many of whom had been deported. And then I was on a conference call the other day, and they said, we find the parents, and the choice they have to make is whether to bring the child back home to wherever the parent is, say Guatemala, which they had left because there was either danger in the location where they were living or the economic insecurity was such that they did not want to stay there. And so that's the choice, bring the child home or leave the child in the States, wherever they are in their current location and their current situation. So these are heartbreaking decisions, but this task force is looking at all options. And I think they're even looking at bringing the parents here. And they're looking, I believe, at reparations for this family separation. There's another task force that's looking at root causes. One of the things that I've thought about through the years is, what's the solution here to the people at the border? And I don't think the solution is to necessarily stop them from coming, but the solution really is creating an at-home situation where they're coming from that is safe and secure and allows them an economic level that is adequate. I don't think they're looking to go to a place to make their fortunes. I think they're just trying to get by. And what we're seeing is increasingly climate change. There have been a couple of tropical storms. I was just reading an article about the tropical storms that came through Honduras and Guatemala and wiped out some of the subsistence farmers. It's just going to drive people further north. And so the root cause collaboration, I think, is a pretty important part of this, because the more we can strengthen these countries and strengthen the economies of those countries, the less likely people will need to leave and come north. So I think that's a very important task force. There were two Department of Homeland Security announcements early on. They wanted to pause the deportations. They wanted to pause the enforcement. The enforcement would have been like here in Charlottesville by ICE. Don't have any more raids. Don't pick any more people up for 100 days. That really was implemented more stringently than the deportations. Went right away to the courts, and there was some controversy about which deportations would be paused, and not all deportations could be paused in this way. So again, some of these issues are still being caught up in the courts. And then we are seeing some congressional changes. There are the first two that you're seeing there, the U.S. Citizenship Act of 2021 would be the comprehensive immigration reform. It touches those three areas of our general immigration law, the family issue, the employment issue. It smooths out some of those problems that we're seeing. The DREAM Act is providing pathways to citizenship for the DACA folks. That's been introduced in the Senate. There were also 10 immigration-related bills passed in the House last year that need to be re-voted on, and the last chance that the House has to do it is coming up later this week. And they have kind of an American Dream and Promise Act similar to the one in the Senate, but it's a little bit more expansive. It not only covers the DACA folks, but the temporary protected status folks, that's H.R. 6. There's a very interesting Farm Worker Workforce and Modernization Act that works on the minimum wage at a federal level for these H-2A visa temporary workers, as well as, in some cases, pathways to citizenship for some of these farm workers. And their Fairness for High-Skilled Immigrants phases out country caps. Remember what I said, that we had these bottlenecks based on country caps that were really inflexible. And so giving the Congress or the president or someone the ability to move these numbers around either between countries or between regions would be a very useful. And that's what that Fairness for High-Skilled Immigrants talks about. And then the Homeland Security Improvements Act is one that I've been watching because it sets the standard for the Customs and Border Protection and ICE. These are really two parts of the Department of Homeland Security that police the immigration issue, either at the border or within the interior, and it sets some standards for those organizations. So again, watch the news later in the week, and you may be seeing notices of whether the House pushes these through administratively. These and other bills were already passed, and what they would need to do is have this Congress re-vote these again, and then they would have to, of course, go into the Senate for a discussion. So that's been a speedy review. I just wanted to put my email up there as a last reminder if you want to jot that down. If afterwards you have any questions about immigration and you think of them later, I work on this pretty much full time and would be happy to answer your questions or send you materials or information or suggestions about how to learn more. My goal really is to get as many Americans as I can to understand the system so that they can understand what's happening in the news and so we can see where our future is here. I'm going to stop sharing, and then maybe we want to see, Peyton, if we had some questions come in from the group or...
Well, Allison, we have a number of questions.
Okay.
And I do want to clarify one thing that you said that I think we can do quickly, and that was you said that 2% of the 2% GDP growth is because of immigration, immigrants.
Yes. Okay. When the economists examine the future of the economy, and they're expecting 2% growth based on these million a year immigrants. And so if the million don't come in, we can take 2% right off the top. Now, if 600,000 come in, I don't know, is that almost half? Is that 1%? Maybe. I don't know the details, but that's kind of a standard thought from the economists.
Right. One of the things we had talked about a little bit was Virginia and immigrants.
Yes.
And you said you were going to give a little bit more on that. One of the questions that came up was whether Virginia law enforcement, that is both of the state and the local area, were helping cooperating with ICE in detentions and all.
Good question.
But really also the general pattern of immigration into particularly central Virginia.
Yes. Okay. Virginia sort of mimics the national immigration levels. So by that, I mean, we have about of our 8.5 million population here in Virginia, we have about 1 million population of immigrants. Again, an immigrant defined here as foreign born. And remember the pie chart. So many of those are naturalized citizens. We have green card holders. We have temporary business or students. So about 1 million immigrant population. We have about 3.2%. That's about the national average of unauthorized residents. So there are about 275,000 unauthorized people living in the state of Virginia. We have about, those residents, those unauthorized residents make up about 4.7% of our workforce. Again, this is a standard kind of at the national level we're mimicking. So that's about on the national level, the percentage of unauthorized residents. We also have about 14,000 DACA recipients. These are the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. That's about half of those who are eligible. Some people are not applying for the DACA status for a number of reasons. But so again, we're kind of the standard. The question about is local law enforcement supporting ICE? It's a really good question. And it's a complicated question. As you know, the immigration issue is a federal issue. And so the question becomes, will the local jurisdictions support ICE in either asking people their immigration status or using the immigration status as a way to arrest someone or to put them in jail or keep them in jail. What we see locally happening is that the local county jail, it's my understanding, the local county jail does make a call to ICE if they think they have someone who's spending time in their jail to notify ICE that they have this person in their custody, which is quite controversial. And there have been people who've protested this issue. The last I read, and I'm not an expert here, the last I read, it was my understanding that there was some kind of a state law that suggested that this needed to take place. I'm not an expert in this area. There is also in throughout the country an agreement that's called a 287G. It's part of the law, in fact, a small law that was passed by in Bill Clinton's time that allowed local jurisdictions to be deputized by ICE. So a local sheriff's office or a local police force could be deputized by ICE in order to be authorized to ask immigration-related questions. Normally, a local police would not have the authority to ask a question about your citizenship and do anything about it. But in this case, when you have this agreement, then you are allowed to ask those questions. So right now in the state of Virginia, we have 287G agreements in Prince William County, in Culpeper, and in Manassas. So there are a few of these agreements in the state of Virginia currently.
And another question that came up that I think is of real interest to everyone is whether someone who graduates from college can get their green card.
Yes. Generally, no. Generally, you would come in on a student visa. There had been in the past, and is quite controversial, kind of a bridge visa. The bridge visa is you've graduated, but you haven't gotten your work visa yet, but you're allowed to kind of be looking for work, and that's going to bridge you to the work visa. So that's why those H-1Bs are so valuable, because they're going to give you the 3-year work visa to stay here temporarily in the country. But there's no mechanism that allows somebody to come in and graduate from the university and then move to the green card. One of the beauties of the system that we had was that those international students became part of the feeder into that million a year. And that was good, because we could then bring people into the system who had had our education. What's happening now is that fewer people are coming. The statistics are down. Now, part of that is based on COVID, of course. But what's sadly happening is we're losing out to China. China is providing free education for people. We're providing expensive education. And so as we look at, again, our competitiveness in the world, we're not competing well for the talent, for the worldwide talent pool that we'd love to attract to the U.S. So I hope that answers the question.
I think it sounded very good. A question was raised about crime and immigrants.
Yeah.
Will you speak to that, please?
Yes. Yes. I had a chart. I did not include it in this. Again, one of the misunderstandings, I think 42% of the survey, I didn't include this question in your chart today, 42% of the American public think that immigrants have a higher crime rate than native-born Americans. And that is not true. All the statistics I have read show that just the opposite is true. In fact, the chart that I would show you is statistics from Texas that combines, I think, 6 years of data in Texas, different kinds of crime. And for every different kind of crime, except for driving violations, driving around town violations, the highest rate of violation, and that's sort of numbers per 100,000, the highest rate is among those of us who are native born. And the next highest rate are the immigrants who are the citizens, but who have their green card or who have come into the process of becoming citizens. And the lowest rate are the unauthorized. So it's rare to see these three categories in a study, which is why it sort of intrigued me. But again, this is a little bit of a misnomer. And I think part of the reason is because people are hearing that the people coming across our border are bringing drugs, and they tend to be criminals, which the numbers don't bear this out. And from having lived at the southern border for winters here for 5 years, I know that there's a misunderstanding of who's bringing the drugs into the country. The drugs actually come in through the ports of entry in the trucks with the goods and services and the vegetables and the crops. But the people coming across the border, by and large, are not criminals, nor are they going to harm us in any way.
Thank you. Question here about policy under Bill Clinton, which gave authority to local sheriff's offices to act as immigration officers and then interrogate people as to their legal immigration status. And the question I'm quoting, am I quoting correctly? And is that policy still being followed?
It's not my understanding that during Bill Clinton's time, he authorized sheriffs or deputized them to enforce immigration. What he did do, this 287G that I mentioned before, was a part of his law, the law that he passed, which was quite controversial. It allowed the deputization of the sheriff or the local police, but only through these agreements. And so you could go to the government website and see where those agreements are currently being enacted. But it wasn't a blanket across the whole country.
Thank you. Another one is, can someone overstay their visa but manage to become a legal immigrant?
Yeah.
I think we need an immigration lawyer really to speak to that one properly, but please, you've studied it. Uh-oh, am I frozen or are you frozen?
I think y'all are
that were cool. Established. Right, right.
I'm sorry, but you froze on me.
Yeah, so. I think you're right. If you wanted to look at the specifics of a case, but generally there are laws that say, if you have lived here illegally, then you will not be allowed to apply for citizenship through the normal process without returning to your home country for sometimes 5 years and sometimes 10 years, depending on how long you've been here.
Okay. And this is almost it's sort of an interesting question. Do border walls that are, and since you were in Arizona, I think you might have some input on this. Do border walls that are 30 feet tall hold back or deter more unauthorized immigrants and contraband than those walls that are 18 feet tall?
I think it doesn't matter how tall the wall is, because people are going to find a way to go over them or under them. So I don't think that the tallness of the wall is going to affect much of anything. And I think that's what the studies already show, that even these new walls are being breached by people at the border.
Having been involved with looking at some of the tunnels that were built, I have an absolute agreement with you on the Southwest. That was a previous life that I was involved in some of that. So it's very interesting how good some of the tunneling is, how well constructed. One of them is asking, with the large number of unaccompanied minors crossing the border, what are the options being looked at to care for those children in place of detention centers, and which do not seem terribly safe or humane?
Yes. Good question. So under President Trump, he had used what's called Title 42 in order to use the COVID rationale for turning everyone back at the border. And that included families or single adults or unaccompanied minors, young children. And right now we're seeing, and Biden has reversed that decision. So Biden has decided we're gonna take these young children. We're not gonna turn them back in harm's way by sending them back to Mexico. And so we're seeing unprecedented numbers of children coming in across the border or presenting themselves. Now, these could be young children who are trying to reunite with their parents who are living here. These could also be young children who have been in families who've lived in northern Mexico for some time, and it's so dangerous there that the parents are deciding the children would be better off if they were to just cross the border on their own. Generally, what happens is There's the Flores Agreement that says you can only hold a child for 72 hours at the Border Patrol. Already the numbers are so great that it's hard to process them in and out in that length of time. Generally, Department of Homeland Security hands the child off to Health and Human Services. And a part of Health and Human Services, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, will take these children and find sponsors. So if there's a family, then the child would go to the family. But it, of course, takes time to vet those families. Well, I just heard the Department of Homeland Security, Mayorkas, talking about the fact that they're trying to get the Health and Human Services people coming to the border and interfacing just as quickly as possible to facilitate the process, because we're back, the system is backing up. So one option is to open up some of these children's centers, and there are several down there in Texas, and this just happened last week, and of course people are up in arms for a number of reasons. We don't want these children to settle into kind of detention center like facilities. And there's a question about whether these detention centers have the proper state level oversight, or whether there's adequate oversight. And of course, the whole process of children being on their own is difficult. And then COVID, you overlay that. So people are scrambling now to try to figure out a way to move these children as quickly as possible through the system so that they can get settled in with their sponsors. They don't want to rush the job so that they're not vetting the sponsors properly, but they also don't want to hold these children in. So now they're talking about, rather than having these be detention-like shelters, having them just be sort of processing hubs, which says bring the children in and out as quickly as possible and farm them out. I know from where I live in the sort of Phoenix, Tucson, Nogales corridor out there in Arizona, the nonprofits are all over this and scrambling. I actually do work with one of the shelters in Tucson and help with the intake. And every day it's different. And they're, you know, they could be getting a busload of people from Yuma, and 50 people are being dropped off tonight, and they have flights out tomorrow to be with their sponsors. So there's a constant kind of inflow, outflow. People need food, they need shelter, and they need transportation to their sponsors who financially pay for their support. So the children's issue is highly in the news these days. You know, the people who are watching closely what the government is going to do, there are lots of people. It seems like this Department of Homeland Security, Mayorkas, understands the issues, and he's a lawyer. He's going to look at things from a legal standpoint. He has a heart. I've heard him talk about his interest in the children. So I think we're going in the right direction. But to sort this out is not an easy, just logistical issue. To make everybody happy, and nobody wants to hold these children for very long. They know that's the worst thing that can happen. So it's a matter of how can they efficiently process them through the system.
Thank you. And another question has come up is, how should we balance the skills of immigrants versus family in deciding who should be admitted?
I think it's a very good question. Even if somebody comes here as a family, chances are they're going to work and they're going to be a skill at some level in the economy. So while we could say, well, we want to just take people who we need in our economy, we sort of need people in all levels. But I think that's the question, that right now we don't have a system that's flexible enough for us to say, well, now we need these kinds of people for our economy, so we'll open up more visas of these categories. We don't have anywhere near that, and that's a system that I think we would love to see. That you're starting to see increasingly businesses coming forward with petitions for the government saying we need more of these kinds of workers. You know, we're seeing some of the immigration reform saying we'd like pathways to citizenship for the dairy workers. We're seeing more. We want more high tech visas for all the people out in Silicon Valley. So I think that's the question, is how do we balance? And maybe in different years, we might need more or less. And if we have big humanitarian crises, maybe we want to have more humanitarian or less. But we don't have a system that allows us to do that. So it's a good question. And how do we balance that? You know, that's yet to be determined. But we don't have a system to make those changes, even if we knew we wanted more or less. So that's part of what we're trying to create here.
Well, I'm going to give you two more questions, and then we'll end up.
Okay.
The first one is, do you think a significant number of crimes against against unauthorized immigrants are going unreported?
Crimes against unauthorized?
Being underreported.
Underreported. I'm thinking about any statistics I've read, and I don't know that I've ever read statistics about this. What I do know about the unauthorized population is that they really try to operate under the radar. And I think it's hard to imagine living in this manner where the children go off to school every day and they're not sure if when they get home at night their parents will be there, because they may have been picked up on the charge of a taillight being out or not signaling a turn or whatever. And so to live in fear means you live sort of under the radar as much as possible. And my guess is that there would be, therefore, many people who would not be willing to report crimes. And I think when we have the debate about whether we want local police to be involved with ICE and to be working closely with ICE, on the one hand, to say, well, we have people here without the proper papers, therefore we want to remove them from our communities, is one thing. But the fear that it instills in the local communities and may prevent them from coming forward and testifying for a crime that they saw, for example, against you or against me, that's the counter issue, that it doesn't create as safe a community as we would like it to be. So I've never seen a statistic about this issue, but my suspicion is that there probably are crimes that are underreported against these people, and maybe other witnesses are not coming forward as much as they could be because of the fear of talking to the police.
Thank you. And the last part I've got is on Reagan's amnesty that he granted to people. What did that consist of?
Reagan said, I don't think it's a good idea to have a large percentage of the population live kind of under the radar like this. It's not good for them and it's not good for us. And so what he said was, and I think he had to do a lot of arm twisting with Congress, actually. I don't think it was an easy thing to put through the system, but he really said, let's say we will allow, as I said before, two groups of people, some general workers and some agricultural workers. Now, there were some conditions. You had to have lived here for a certain length of time. You had to have paid taxes all that time. Many of the people who are here working are paying into Social Security. They're paying taxes. They're filing taxes with the IRS, not with a Social Security number, but with a special IRS number. So they've been paying taxes. There would be a requirement maybe to prove that in the community they were in good standing with letters of reference. They would maybe have to pay a fine. So there was a whole process for people to come forward and to allow them to create a pathway to citizenship. And again, it was a long process of applying, getting a green card, maybe 5 years, then becoming a citizen. So the end result was that about 3 million people became citizens in this manner in that 1986 regularization, it's called, which is the same as amnesty. And the interesting thing that Reagan did was he then turned around and he said, now I think through an executive order or some other legal method, he said, we're going to take all the children of those people who we just regularized and they became citizens. We're going to make them citizens as well, because we don't want to leave those people behind, you know, in the system and not give them citizenship. So he was quite holistic in the way that he approached this. And it was meant to solve a problem that we saw. It turns out that we didn't prevent more people from coming. So they're, you know, in the discussion of legislation, they want to talk about pathways to citizenship for those who are here, enforcement to prevent, you know, future flows. And we've got to talk about both sides of the coin.
Thank you. Allison, I want to thank you for giving this presentation, trying to compress many years into and a very complex subject into an hour and a half is quite a feat. And I think you did an excellent job. And I've gotten a couple of comments in the Q&A to that effect as well.
Great. Thank you. So, thank you for having me.
So I really appreciate it. And I believe you'll be receiving something at some point in the mail, but I can't say exactly when.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Rich may be giving it to you today after the presentation. I'm not sure where, whether all he's right. got one there. I do want to thank all of our attendees. I know some found this to be a little longer than they expected, but I think the time was well spent. I do want to mention that our next meeting is going to be on the 14th of April, again at 1:30. And I have just forgotten what the topic is. Rich, can you?
Yes, it's on mental health that's in our locality.
Ah, and that's why I couldn't remember, because it's on mental health.
Great speakers coming in.
So it should be a very good one. And of course, we do have Senior Statesmen of Virginia meetings every month on the second Wednesday. Any of you who would like to become a member, we'd be happy to have you do so. If you go to our website, you'll see the information on that. And we hope we'll see you at another gathering. I'm sorry, I've got a couple. Oh, more thank yous are coming in on the Q&A.
Thank you.
So appreciate your being here.